493 of the Survival Podcast. As far as Bitcoin breakouts, this is our 50th Bitcoin breakout on the podcast. I am really excited to have Stephen Lupka from Swan Bitcoin to come on the show. I pinged a few people over at Swan here and there over the years about getting somebody on, and we just never got it together. And then somebody reached out to me recently, and I'm like, who can we get on? They suggested Stephen. I'm like, this is awesome. Let's go. So we're going to be talking about Bitcoin today. We're going to talk about what's different in 2024 than, let's say, even the last epoch in, say, 2021 in the last cycle. Some of the impacts on big money coming in, institutional investors. We'll talk about, you know, traditional finance managers and their role in this, the success of the ETFs, all kinds of stuff. Why I agree with when I got Stephen's application that 2024 will be the most significant year yet for Bitcoin. So we'll talk about that. And basically, Bitcoin's future is money. Before we do that, though, let's go ahead and take care of our sponsors today. Sponsor today, number one today, it ain't a Bitcoin company, but I bet you Anton over there would take Bitcoin for his product. Anton's Land of Biltong. Guys, I take part of my sponsorship payment for them in meat. In fact, I'm going to be like in a hurry to get this interview done because I just got my shipping notification that my Duars dry sausages and my Biltong just arrived, like just before I hit go. Didn't even have time to go grab one for a snack. But this stuff is awesome. Anton is from South Africa. He makes the product right. I'm kind of a Biltong aficionado. So when he wanted to do something with the show, I'm like, you got to send me some stuff first, man. I got to check this stuff out. It is fantastic. It is addictive. By Tuesday of every other week when I know my shipment's coming in, my mouth starts watering. I start craving it. If you give it a try, you'll like it. You can buy, you know, one package, a bunch of package, one off. You can also sign up where they will ship it to you every 2 weeks like I get it. Check it out today, Anton's Land of Biltong, and MSB members, you guys get a discount, so definitely check that out. And we are talking about wealth today, because Bitcoin is, in my opinion, the hardest form of money and wealth known to man. And if you want to stay switched on everything that's going on in the markets, trading, etc., you want to check out John Pugliano's Wealth Steading Podcast. It is a podcast that comes out about once every 2 weeks. It's a short podcast, about 15 minutes. John is one of us. He is a prepper. He's been involved with our community since 2010 when I first met him in Salt Lake City at a convention. He's a member of the Expert Council. He's a guy you know you can listen to and you know you can trust, and he is a fantastic investment manager as well. So check out the Wealth Steading Podcast and glean from John's wisdom. With that, I want to go ahead and bring our special guest on, Stephen Lupka. And Stephen, welcome to the Survival Podcast and the Bitcoin Breakout.
It's a pleasure to be here, my man. It's I'm excited to have this conversation, and I know probably the guests don't usually comment on the sponsors, but I love Biltong, and I'm okay. Going to check that out because that looked really good.
You've got the lean face of a protein and fat consumer there, and I think that's become a thing in the Bitcoin space too. Is like The whole keto carnivore, meat is good, seed oil is bad thing. Like there's a lot of overlap, right?
There's a huge amount of overlap. I think there's a big intersection between the Bitcoin world and the health world. And I'm actually well known on the internet for being the Bitcoin sunlight guy. I'm a big,
cool.
I'm a big kind of outdoor, get some sun, you know, get some steps in. So yeah.
Cool, man. You know, I think part of that is that when people discover what fiat money is, they start to ask what else in our world is fiat, right? Like fiat food, you know, fiat medicine, fiat everything. And they start looking for what's real.
I get asked that question, like, why is it that Bitcoiners like tend to go this way? And I've always answered in the exact same way you did. The moment you figure out, if everything I believed about money was wrong, I wonder what else I'm wrong about.
Yeah.
You know, it sets you kind of down that process.
That's a great lead up to my first question for you. So what I always like to ask guests that come on the show, no matter what their subject area is, what brought you here? Like, let's go back. Steven's hanging out in study hall in high school. He's probably not thinking about, you know, being a significant member of a Bitcoin team someday. There's probably no Bitcoin. If you know, you're anywhere close to my age, Bitcoin and high school don't go together. How do you come, like, what is your professional background and how did you come into the world of Bitcoin?
Yeah, absolutely. So I kind of came at it a little bit from a technical background. I had previously, before Bitcoin, I had managed a software, kind of a custom software development agency from the business side. So I'm not a programmer, but I would kind of help with the business side, clients, kind of doing custom work for companies, small businesses, etc. And I did that for a while. And then in 2017, I discovered Bitcoin, and I was hooked. I was obsessed. Like the idea was so exciting to me. It was so interesting to me. And first, from kind of a technology side, I actually was relatively ignorant to the monetary argument for Bitcoin, which is really kind of the big one that most people know today. But I was relatively ignorant at first. I kind of saw it as a network, and it is a network, and it is a technology, but it's also a money. And it was only probably the next year, in 2018, where I truly came to understand the importance of money and the system of money, and how that system having different qualities can impact what comes from that. And I feel like that's the moment where Bitcoin truly clicked for me. I needed to have the technical piece, but also the monetary piece.
You know, there's a lot of people in this space that want to do what you've done, which is make it part of their profession.
Sure.
Like, how did you find Swan? And like, were you in the Bitcoin space professionally, or did you have other professional background that enabled you to get into this position with Swan?
Yeah, so it's a cool story, actually, a little bit. So the way I met Swan, so I had worked as a consultant for investors in the Bitcoin space, but that was very just me doing it. So it was very kind of grassroots. It was kind of a part-time thing rather than I was kind of running the software agency at that time. So I had done some work in the industry, but very, very kind of, by my bootstraps sort of deal. And then what happened is, during the start of the COVID era, during lockdowns, there was this app that got very popular called Clubhouse, and it was like audio over the internet. That then became Twitter Spaces, basically. So everyone's locked down, everyone's in their home, they can't, or they're restricted in some capacities. And this was like the first 2 months of the pandemic. And I'm on Clubhouse like every day. Bitcoin's going up. Bitcoin's rallying for the first time in 3 years. And all I want to do is talk about Bitcoin. So I go on there and I start hosting rooms about Bitcoin. I start just kind of doing education, talking with people. And I meet the Swan guys. I mean, Swan was probably 10 employees, 10 people at that time. We're like 200 now. So, I mean, it's a huge kind of growth trajectory. But I kind of met some of the Swan guys, and I kept kind of hosting those rooms and interacting and participating with Corey and Brandon and Brady. And I woke up one day to a job offer from Corey with no context. So he had liked what I was saying. He liked the participation. So definitely the coolest kind of story I have for getting a job. But what's the lesson there? What can a listener take away from that? Bitcoin is a proof of work community. If you want to work in Bitcoin, get online, plug into Bitcoin Twitter, plug into Bitcoin Spaces, and put your voice out there and start adding value. Start writing, start speaking, start educating, start whatever it is. Like, if you want to participate and you want to work in Bitcoin, the best way to do that is just show up and start learning. And someone will notice you. And that's how most people I know have gotten careers in the space.
That's good advice. It's you're not going to go to Indeed and find, Bitcoin administrator, your bachelor's degree or equivalent, like Karenized, cut and paste job descriptions. You have to make an impact. Let's talk about, as far as impact goes, like the current Bitcoin rally, and your app came in a few months ago, or like about a month ago, and things were a little higher on the chart here. But when you look at it over a year, this is a rally. I mean, I don't know about you. I log in to like different social media platforms all the time. I'm like, Bitcoin's crashing. I'm like, I'm going to go buy some. And you go look at the price. You go, that's not a crash.
No.
But what do you think's been driving things over this last, piece of this going into this next cycle?
Yeah. So there's two main stories, right? There is the ETF. There's the ETF angle, right? So that was kind of a big catalyst. We had the first spot ETF approvals, and then we had a huge amount of inflows, a huge amount of capital kind of coming into those products. The other story, though, I mean, everyone knows that. Everyone knows the ETF story. But what is the kind of, besides that, it is this emerging scenario of some people call it fiscal dominance, but a kind of a simpler way of putting that is just that the amount of debt that the Treasury is issuing is at wartime levels. It is going up to the COVID highs. And so even though so you have monetary policy, which is the Federal Reserve, and then you have fiscal policy, which is the Treasury, the government itself. And so everyone knows that the Federal Reserve post-COVID, they started tightening their policy, meaning making it more restrictive. They raised interest rates. Mortgage rates went from 2.5% to 8%. You know, there was some contraction in the stock market before it started rallying again. So the Federal Reserve has been in a restrictive position. However, around the time that the stock market actually bottomed and started going up again, the Treasury flipped to a very stimulating position of debt issuance. So they are spending new dollars into the economy at near record paces. This is trillions, over $1 trillion a quarter at some of the estimates. And so these new dollars, it really doesn't matter. You actually could say that the Treasury doing this actually has more impact than some of the monetary policies. But the net result is that new dollars are entering the system. This is money printing by a different name. These are just different ways in which money is printed. Now, what is the effect of issuing new currency into the system? I'm sure your listeners know this, but it is inflation of goods, but also of assets, right? So if you issue more currency, you're debasing the value of one unit of currency, and you're also circulating this through the system. So you're seeing inflation continues to tick back up, asset prices continue to trade near highs, despite the Federal Reserve being where they are. Now, what's really interesting here is that this creates a bind. It creates a bind for the Federal Reserve, and it creates a bind for the federal government. And what that bind is if the Federal Reserve raises interest rates, then all of that debt has to pay more interest. Yeah. And those are new dollars. That is actually dollars that have to be created. Yeah. So, you know, that money market account that you probably have maybe a little bit of cash in, it's paying 5% now. If the Federal Reserve goes to 6%, well, now it's paying 6%. Right? That's a simplification. But when they raise rates, they're basically giving a cash dividend to anybody with a lot of cash that's either holding treasury bonds or in money market accounts. So that is ultimately inflationary, and that is ultimately, in a sense, stimulating the system. But what happens if they lower rates? Well, if they lower rates, that is also a form of stimulus. They're now making the time value of money, they're making this cheaper. And so regardless of what they do, they're in a position where either one of their actions will be inflationary and will be stimulating for asset prices.
Yeah, they've gone so high with the debt, if they cut interest rates, they turn back on inflation as we experienced it over the last 10 years on turbochargers at this point. Yeah. But if they raise rates to curtail inflation, you need inflation to pay the interest on the debt. And I think what helps people sometimes is they're related to something that they can understand, because when you start talking trillions of dollars, like, think of it like your house, and you're like me, you bought your house 10 years ago, so you have a 3% interest rate. What if somebody could just magically turn your interest rate to 6% in the house you're already in?
Yeah.
That's kind of what they have to do to themselves to raise rates, because they have to cover the debt on their own balance sheet, and then they have to print money to cover the debt, the interest cost. It is a bind. Can that kind of lead into why you think maybe this year, and I would say this cycle, might be the most significant one for Bitcoin in its existence so far?
Absolutely. And let me add one more way for people to think of it from a kind of larger scale perspective. I think your analogy is good from the personal perspective, but I think this is helpful too. The total interest expense on the federal debt, assuming rates stay constant and issuance stays constant this year, will approach all of the profits made by all companies on the stock market. The total sum of all U.S. publicly traded companies, all of their earnings, you're going to see the interest expense, those are going to be similar, which means that that's like the total sum of all U.S. productive activity in the public sector. It's incredible, astonishing. Anyways, so why is this year going to be, I think, such an important one? It's the combination of A, you have a setup where there is all this kind of monetary and fiscal pressures that will be good for Bitcoin, but you have this coming at the same time as it is easier than ever before to get Bitcoin. There are more people and institutions than ever before who can express a long Bitcoin position. So, for example, prior to the ETFs launching, if you were the average money manager, financial advisor, RIA, or even a hedge fund or an institutional investor, you couldn't buy Bitcoin even if you wanted to because of regulation. That's now different. We're now in a world where anybody that wants to own Bitcoin can own Bitcoin, whether as directly, like actually own the coins themselves. That's what we do. That's what Swan does. Make it easy for you to buy the real thing, not the paper thing. But if you can't do that, you can now get the ETF. And, you know, yeah, you don't own the coins themselves, but, you know, it is a spot product. So there are coins being bought to back it. And so this is a real change. This is the really fundamental change in the market structure, that you have kind of this kind of fundamental pressure from kind of the government, from fiscal stimulus, from potential monetary stimulus, because I think the Fed will be forced to cut rates here at some point in this year. And so that's going to boost asset prices. And you're going to see it at the same time that the on-ramp is 10 times the size it's ever been. And so I've seen this firsthand because of my job. I run the high net worth investment team for Swan. We do concierge relationships with investors. We're also a retail brokerage platform. So we're one of the easiest places. You don't have to be a high net worth investor. You can just sign up. We make it super easy. But as a result of my position, I've seen this firsthand where when there's a big, so when the Silicon Valley bank failures happened, right, we had several of the banks go down, and that was where the Fed stepped in and FDIC stepped in, and they bailed out these banks that were failing. Bitcoin rallied from like 19K to 27K at that time. It was like a sudden large move. We saw incredible volumes. We saw just huge, huge interest. And what this shows you is that when there's kind of an event, when people, there's something that happens in the market, and suddenly everybody, even people that weren't thinking about Bitcoin, are like, wait a minute, maybe I should buy some Bitcoin now that this thing is happening. The next time we get to one of those moments, which will happen sooner or later, I think most likely sooner rather than later, the ability for people to be like, okay, you know, the banks are failing, or there's inflation, or they're doing a new PPP program, they're doing a new stimulus check, there's this, there's that. Everybody can just log into their brokerage account, they can click the buy button, and they can buy Bitcoin. And that could not happen before. And so when you see this kind of event that causes the average person to say, hey, maybe I should buy some Bitcoin, more people will be able to do that than ever before. And I think that will be hugely constructive for price.
Yeah, I think there's a lot to this too with ETFs that I haven't heard a lot of people talk about. One is that it is only a matter of time till a lot of the pension fund managers, et cetera, start putting at least some percentage into Bitcoin. And so pension fund managers manage things for like city employees, like cops and teachers and things like that. So all of this noise that we've heard over the years, they're going to ban Bitcoin, it's going to go to zero, blah, 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 the Peter Schiffs of the world. I think about the only thing that you touch less as a politician than the retirement account of a cop or a teacher is an Indian reservation. Like, that's your fourth, like, the third rail is that, and then the Indian reservation is like a fourth rail. You don't, no. Like, I think it becomes untenable to overregulate the space now to the point of, like, trying to push it out of existence.
Yeah.
Because that was already, like, good luck, right? That's how we felt for, I've been in this game since 2013. Good luck with that. But now it's a totally different thing. And I think that also adds to, like, investor confidence. And then the other thing I really hope to see, I've got to believe the VanEck, the BlackRock, et cetera, are taking all of their marketing apparatus and kind of pushing on things like 401ks. Because there's literally no reason now that a Bitcoin ETF couldn't be in a 401k. So you got some of the largest marketing departments in the world pushing on Karen and human resources across the board. Hey, we need to add this to your 401.
Yeah. So 100% agree there. And so we have seen probably 1% of all the marketing that we're going to see from BlackRock, from Fidelity. They have the largest sales marketing machinery in the world of finance. Like, this is the big dog, and they're going to turn all of that machinery to bear. So the Bitcoin ETF that BlackRock launched is their most successful ETF launch of all time. It is the most successful ETF launch of all time, period. And it represents over 50% of all new assets they've taken on this year so far is just the Bitcoin ETF. It is enormously successful, enormously popular, and they're going to be promoting that. They're going to be adding it into their existing funds. They're going to be promoting it in their products. This hasn't even started yet. I have it on very good authority. I have it from sources that are kind of in these conversations with these firms. There's so much coming that has not come yet. So we're only in the early innings of the ETF story. We're only in the early innings of this new era of fiscal dominance, and we're still early with Bitcoin. Most people still do not understand Bitcoin, and so these are all really constructive trends. And I'm with you. I mean, I'm very bullish on 2024 and 2025 being a watershed year for the asset.
And then, you know, ETFs, Hong Kong just approved theirs.
Yep.
And correct. We think of, like, Hong Kong as like a city. But it's a pretty big place, and it has the largest per capita number of millionaires in the world.
The financial hub, yeah.
Right, yes. It is an incredibly wealthy demographic, and wealth in Bitcoin, we've seen what happens when wealthy people get involved with Bitcoin. And I think from what I'm hearing you saying, like, that's happening more and more anyway.
Yeah. Australia is also now pushing for ETFs. You're going to see a wave of these ETFs around the world. Now, let's be clear here. The U.S. capital market dwarfs all other capital markets. Not like, you know, but, you know, if you get 15 major markets that you get Hong Kong, you get Australia, you get Japan, you get Europe. OK, if all those guys put together a spot ETF, we're looking pretty good. Like, you know, these are positive developments. They're going to happen. But just, you know, to set expectations, nothing's going to be like the U.S. approval. But the U.S. approval has a lot of room to run. Like, we're not there yet at all.
Yeah. Yeah, I completely agree with that. Do you think that we need to look at not just how the ETFs translate to Bitcoin price, but a massive incentive for traditional finance firms to get more involved overall?
Absolutely. So let me paint this picture for your audience and give kind of a window into, like, how Wall Street works a little bit. So let's say you're a hedge fund manager, you're a trader, you run a proprietary trading shop on Wall Street. Like, what does your world look like? How are you being evaluated? What are your pressures and what are your incentives? The main thing that happens, if you're someone who manages a book, which means you trade a portfolio, you make investments on Wall Street, the only thing you care about is not how much money you made or how much money you lost. It's how much more money you made than the guy you're being compared against.
Okay.
Right? It's not like you, like, if you made 8% this year, but the other guy made 10, it was a bad year.
Okay.
If you lost 3%, but the other guy lost 10%, it's a great year. You won. So it's not about the numbers like you might think. It's about the how you're being compared. Why is this? Because if you outperform the competition, The investors that are in their fund, they take their money and they go to your fund. So all these guys care about is who they're being compared against. Up until now, your competition, none of you could buy Bitcoin. So you didn't care because you couldn't buy Bitcoin, but neither could the next guy.
Okay.
So it's kind of like whatever. But now anybody can buy Bitcoin or will be able to soon once compliance approvals. So now what happens is the guy down the street at the other fund, he has an overweight Bitcoin position and he beats the pants off the next guy. There's this quick series of adjustment where you need to own Bitcoin or all the money's going to leave your fund in some cases. We saw something like this year with NVIDIA stock. So if you the fund managers that were overweight NVIDIA stock, that was it. That was the only thing you needed to do. Basically, if you had a double or triple size position of NVIDIA stock, you beat everybody else. And if you didn't own NVIDIA, you looked like an idiot. And that same exact thing is going to happen with Bitcoin as it goes through this next bull run. And it's just incentives.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny on the NVIDIA thing. So my old man is like an old school stock investor.
Yeah.
And he made a ton of money over the last few years on NVIDIA.
Sure.
And he had no idea why. He was pure TA.
Yeah.
It was a pure technical analysis. He has no idea what the hell Bitcoin is, but he was still able to pick that stock. But I think most people aren't like my old man. And so they knew why they were in the NVIDIA game, right? And now they can get direct instead of indirect exposure because there was an awful lot of buying manufacturers, mining companies, stocks like MicroStrategy.
Sure.
Because they could get exposure with that money, but that was the only way they could do it because that money is – this is something I had to explain to my audience over and over because there was a lot of resistance to ETFs in the Bitcoin space. It's paper. It's fake. And, like, no one's telling you to sell your Bitcoin and go buy ETFs. We're talking about walls of money that cannot access Bitcoin
Correct.
The way that
exactly.
we do with private people.
Exactly.
And now those walls of money are falling in.
Yeah.
And I think what you're saying is it's kind of like an avalanche. Like, this looks bad as it starts to slide down, but as it goes, it builds momentum and it brings more with it.
Yeah, you nailed it, man. It's you should buy actual Bitcoin. I absolutely recommend that you buy spot Bitcoin. You don't buy the ETF. However, there are so many pools of capital that can't make that choice. They need the ETF. And so that's why it's been very positive. That's why it's been very good is it opens it up to buyers that simply could not buy it before. You can go and you're saving money. Let's also be clear. It's not just some ideological stance of like, oh, it's better, like own your own keys. No, if you buy the ETF, you're giving BlackRock some of your Bitcoin every year.
Yep.
Just to hold it. There's no reason to pay that fee. You buy real Bitcoin, you never pay fees again. You pay fees once to buy it, and then that's it. And what would you rather? Would you rather pay fees once or every year? So you should buy actual Bitcoin. However, if you're a fund manager on Wall Street or you're a financial advisor, a pension, a firefighter's pension, a lot of these people, they can't do it. So they buy the ETF, and that's fine. And that's why it's a big deal.
And, you know, like I said, we haven't really had the big push into the 401k space yet.
Yeah.
But there's plenty of people. They've been with their employer 10 years. They're going to be there another 20 years. They can't get that money out. It's held captive.
Yep.
And there's 400 grand sitting there. And they would love to allocate even 50 to Bitcoin. They have no way to do that. But now they do. And people have been mentioned if your 401k has a brokerage option, you could do that. But the issue with that is –
very few do.
Very few do.
It's
probably easier to get BlackRock to push, you know, IBIT or whatever into the 401k than it is to get that option. Because, and the reason I think employers won't do it, you know, I used to run companies. I would not put a lot of effort into doing something that I thought only a very small percentage of people in my company would do.
Correct.
Right. So most people are not, I remember my employees, man, when you put 401k in front of them, they just did whatever the guy that came in to brief them said. Right. They never really thought about it. They didn't understand.
They perform very poorly. Perform very poorly. You know.
But if they could just go click a box and 5% goes to Bitcoin, they'll do that, especially now. I think maybe more.
And so just so you know, one thing that we do, and we do this all the time, if you have an old 401k, that's fair game. You can roll that over. We do these every week. We roll over a ton of 401ks for our users from old employers, and you can buy spot Bitcoin in there. So if you got an old plan, you can roll it over to a company like Swan and get Bitcoin. If you're with a current employer, well, you know, then you have these restrictions.
Can you talk about a little bit more about how all of these changes are pushing more in the traditional finance manager space?
Yeah, so the thing that people should understand that aren't close to this to the finance industry is that it moves slow. So what we're seeing right now, we're still in this period where most wealth management platforms, they still can't freely offer the Bitcoin ETF. I'll give an example from I'm close to the situation at Morgan Stanley. So here's how it works at Morgan Stanley. Morgan Stanley has one of the largest networks of advisors that work for the company. So if you go set up, even if you're just an average guy, if you go set up an account at Morgan Stanley, they're going to assign you like a person that you work with. And that's your advisor. And so Morgan Stanley has this huge network. And there's something called solicitation and non-solicitation. And what it means is it's basically whether or not that advisor can bring up the asset to you, can bring up Bitcoin to you. And so if it's in non-solicitation mode, they cannot mention it to you. If you mention it to them, they can give it to you, but they can't talk about it. And so Morgan Stanley, since the launch of these products, they've been in like a compliance process. They're reviewing it. They're doing due diligence, legal processes, and they're trying to move it from non-solicitation to solicitation. And I think they're going to be one of the first ones to do this. And the moment that switch turns on, suddenly 10,000 plus money financial advisors can now recommend the Bitcoin ETF to their clients, and some portion of them will. And this is happening not just at Morgan Stanley, but at Raymond James, at Edward Jones, at all UBS, at all of these places, as well as independent and small financial advisors, mom and pop shops. So, you know, there's a process of like getting comfortable with it that's still happening, and it moves slow, but we're going to see that roll out across this year.
Cool. Has this changed the conversations that you're having? Because I know you're involved in like concierge service, high net worth service with, you know, like people that are managing money, like registered investment advisors and maybe family offices and things like that.
Absolutely. We're having a lot more of those conversations, and they're a lot more warmed up to the idea, you know, so it's both, there's more interest, and I think people take it more seriously. So it definitely has moved the needle on those.
Okay. I am one of these people that it took me a while to go all in on just Bitcoin. I was never a big shitcoiner, but what I called myself instead of a Bitcoin maximalist was a shitcoin minimalist. And it was some of the developments in Lightning that took away some use case scenarios, but it was also when I started to watch people build things on top of Bitcoin, like value for value in podcasting would be an example. The integration of the ability to exchange value for value on networks like Nostr. And I kind of looked at that and went, okay, so the things that I've been holding out and saying we need another technology for are kind of dead. I don't think that's the way many people have done it. I think, but we have moved into much more of people understanding the fundamental difference between Bitcoin and crypto. Yeah. You know, and I can go back to 2017 going, hey, I think that these alt things have some interesting use cases, but I would still always say, I think Bitcoin could still eat everything. And now I'm like, Bitcoin's eating everything. Have you seen that mindset, that sea change shift as well? Because I'm sure there was probably a time when people were like, why can't I buy, you know, Algorand through Swan or something like that?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, 2021, we dealt with that a lot. So, yeah, we've seen that. And I think it's part of a few I think there's a few reasons for that. I think one is all the development in Bitcoin. So Bitcoin continues to innovate, continues to grow. And, you know, we've just seen a huge success, right? Bitcoin got an ETF. Nothing else got an ETF. Why did nothing else get an ETF? Because Bitcoin's the only thing that isn't seen as a security at this stage. So it has a regulatory kind of, you know, they've allowed it, you know, it's been allowed through, other things not, you know, Bitcoin's kind of growing, it's outperformed. You know, the value of like one Ethereum versus one Bitcoin has just trended down all for the last year, pretty much nonstop. So there's a lot of like, I think, success stories, there's new applications, there's all sorts of things happening on Bitcoin. That's part of it. Part of it is Bitcoin's success. But the other part of it is, I think, crypto's failure. And so what you see from 2017 onward is, so 2017, we have ICOs. It was all about ICOs. And then those were a bust. Like, those all went to basically zero. And then you have DeFi in 2020. And then DeFi is the big thing. And then in 21, you have NFTs. NFTs are the big thing. DeFi, it's all taken a nosedive. NFTs, most of them are down 98%. Then you have FTX, you have Terra Luna, BlockFi, sell all these blow-ups. Everyone loses money. And so, A, there's just been this huge kind of tarnished reputation of just failed idea after failed idea. And then this time, this bull market, they don't even have a new idea. There's no new ICOs, DeFi, like there's no new thing. There's no new shiny object to run people's money into. The only thing that's happening is meme coins. And these are literally like, they're literally just memes. There's no. Like, they're gamble. They're literally just gambling. And for people who want to gamble, fine. You want to gamble, gamble. I don't care if you gamble. But, like, there's no innovation. There's no big new idea. And so this time, they haven't even been able to get a new concept out in front.
Yeah.
And so what you've seen is just, like, pretty much everything has underperformed Bitcoin.
Yeah. Yeah. And, I mean, like I said, my big thing is nobody's building anything on any of these other cryptos, including the forks. Like, the Bitcoin Cash people are just nauseating at times, and, you know, it's the real Bitcoin or whatever. So the thing that changed is the, yeah, whatever. Ver's got his new book out and all. But when Bitcoin Cash came out, it didn't really interest me except for one piece of it that nobody really talked about, which was SLP, or Simple Ledger Protocol. And there was all these things about micro tipping and split payments and all, and like Lightning's actually doing now.
Yeah.
SLP never did. And when they, yeah. Do you want to piss off a shitcoiner? Who's building what on your shitcoin? Yeah. And there's no answer. But if you want to say who's building what on Bitcoin, there's 1,000 companies now. And then private initiatives and just like hackers and all, building technology on top of and integrating Bitcoin. And to me, that is the real future, because we have programmable money, but somebody needs to program it to do something. And I don't think you're going to see a lot of people whipping out their Bitcoin and buying a car full price for it. Like, it's too valuable to take hard money and buy a fiat product. But these small purchases, these value for value exchanges and things like that, you know, like buying dinner or something, like, I think that's kind of the future of how we have spendable Bitcoin and kind of stacked, you're never getting this, it's mine, Bitcoin. Like, because I have that kind of mindset. Like, when people say, well, Lightning has some risks if you don't self-custody, and even if you do run your own node. And I'm like, yeah, but I have at any given time a few $100 there.
Yeah, it's a checking account.
I don't even care. Like, if I went out this weekend and I tapped an ATM and I put $300 in cash and $20 bills in my pocket, if I lost it Saturday night, it fell out of my pocket when I was in the bathroom or something, I'm not happy, but my life's not altered. Yeah. I haven't lost, like, I don't carry my life savings around in my pocket. So I think that we're having like all these new ways that we can actually use Bitcoin. I've talked about this. Like, I look at what Fountain's doing. I'm like, how can't we spread this everywhere? Like, are you familiar with the traffic app Waze, where like people tell you there's a cop or there's an accident? Imagine that app with sats tipping in it.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. There's a ton of stuff built. There's so many. I think that's one of the things that always kind of impressed me the most about the Bitcoin community, is when I really started to get involved, there's so many brilliant people. I just met so many brilliant people that were so passionate and working so hard to build things in this space. And it's just a pleasure to know those people, talk with those people, be a part of some of those stories. Like, it's, you know, And I think a lot of investors will, I've heard that from a few investors who made like, you know, kind of rich traditional investors that made large allocations, like Bill Miller, Stanley Druckenmiller, Tim Draper. A lot of these guys report like, I mean, a big part of why they did it is just all the talent and the brilliant people, the passionate people working on this.
Absolutely. Backing up a little bit on changing investment strategies, my favorite person that talks about Bitcoin that hates it is Peter Schiff. And I use favorite tongue in cheek. I honestly think Peter only talks about Bitcoin because otherwise nobody would pay attention to him anymore. I mean, he's got a rock to sell and that's it. He's got a gold fund. But I think that more and more money is moving out of gold into Bitcoin as that financial hard money reserve.
It is. Absolutely. I think you saw this when the ETFs launched, the Bitcoin ETFs, it was like the Bitcoin ETFs were taking in $500 million a day and the gold ETFs were losing money every day. You know, it's not saying that all of that went to Bitcoin or anything, but you saw this long period of like money leaving the Bitcoin gold ETFs, Bitcoin ETFs gaining money. You're going to see more and more of that over time. Am I saying gold's going to disappear? No, I'm not saying gold's going to disappear. But like, is Bitcoin going to outperform the heck out of it? Like, yes, absolutely.
That's awesome. That's awesome. I really do. I just think that like what got me with that totally on board was when Saylor first kind of came on the scene and he was talking, what does it cost to move $100 million from Los Angeles to Tokyo in gold?
Yeah.
It's like, well, you need guys with guns.
Yeah, you need
you need regulatory approval. You need a lot of cargo space on aircraft or ships to get it over there. You have risk the entire time. And if I want to take my Bitcoin to Tokyo, I just go to Tokyo. I don't even have to move it.
No.
If I did need to move it, like I wanted to transfer it from one entity to the other, it's a few hundred dollars.
Right. And I mean, that is historically like, let's look at the history here. Like, why did gold fail? And I'm going to let me define what I mean by fail, because obviously gold's worth more today in a certain way. Failed as in gold was money. That's what money was. And now it's not. It was replaced by fiat. So in that sense, gold failed. Why did gold fail? It failed because of the lack of portability, because it was always going to be the case. It was always going to be, you were never going to pay for a cup of coffee with a gold coin. Like, how do you do that? Like, I mean, even silver, it's hard. Like, you know, and so it was inevitable. It was inevitable based on the very properties of the commodity that people were going to put it in banks and the banks were going to issue paper receipts against the gold. Because the paper was very portable, it's divisible, you can do 1/1000th of a gold bar paper. And the moment you have that situation where all of the gold gets custodied by banks, they were going to rehypothecate it. They were going to issue more paper receipts than there was gold. You're going to have inflation, you're going to have monetary debasement, you're going to have all of these things. It was born of the lack of portability and the lack of ability for the average person to store it effectively. And so that's one of the big advantages of Bitcoin, is that with Bitcoin, you don't need to rely on a third party to custody your Bitcoin, to transact with your Bitcoin, or to do anything with your Bitcoin. And so it has all of the best properties of gold with all of the best properties of dollars, digital dollars.
Yeah. And for our friend Peter, this is one of the things people don't really pay attention to or know, because I bet he owns a lot of Bitcoin. I think it's just a marketing scheme, honestly. But if you go to Shift Gold and you want to buy gold, they'll take Bitcoin for it.
They will, yeah. And it's a marketing scheme. You know, it's like people realize this on the internet. Peter McCormick calls it the Bitcoin cheat code.
Yeah.
And it's essentially like the moment you start tweeting or saying anything about Bitcoin, you get 100 times the engagement you would get otherwise, because there's just so many Bitcoiners on the internet that just like jump in.
And if you're well known and you come out negative, then they attack you. And that's the P.T. Barnum thing. You can give me any publicity, but spell my name right. Right.
Like, exactly. Yeah. It's still beneficial for them. And so, yeah, Peter benefits from being attacked by Bitcoiners, because even if 100 people take shots at him, there's at least 10 people on the sidelines that are like, they agree with him, that don't like Bitcoin. And so they go with him because they don't like Bitcoin. It's just all a publicity thing.
He's playing the same game that BlackRock is with Bitcoin, right? Like, if you buy physical gold from Shift Gold, he makes the same percentage whether gold is expensive or cheap.
Yeah.
And if you buy his fund, he's charging a management fee whether gold goes up or down. So he wants is assets under management and sell a physical product. It doesn't matter. He's profitable either way.
Yeah, it's not a performance. He's not trying to perform, you know. He's just trying to collect fees. Which is the problem with modern finance. Like, let's be clear. Like, that paradigm is what has impaired capital markets. You just have this big problem of risk aversion where everyone just wants to collect passive fees, and that has been divorced from intelligently taking risk to deliver returns, right?
Yeah.
Because everyone is being compared against the indexes and index investing, which is like, just buy the S&P 500, just buy the NASDAQ. And it's like, if the S&P 500 is the baseline, then if you do anything too far away from that, everyone's like, oh, your fund is too risky because compared to indexing, it has higher volatility. But because of that, nobody can do anything. You can't actually do your job. And it's just a big fee collection scheme.
Yeah. I mean, I've talked about this for years. Like, when you go into a fund and you listen to Edward Jones or whoever that sells the fund, and you're buying a mid-cap stock fund, they give you this image of like this super trading team and this super fund manager, and they're looking at this stock and going, let's take this out of the fund and let's add this one. And the reality is, they have to buy a certain kind of stock, and they have to stay invested in that kind of stock in that fund, because if they go too heavy on cash, they're no longer qualified to be listed as a mid-cap ETF.
It's so absurd.
That's why they all perform almost the same.
Exactly.
Right? Exactly. Like, with it, not individual managers, but individual funds. Like, mid-cap funds all perform about the same. Small cap, all about the same. Emerging markets, all about the same, because they're holding the same shit.
And because that's actually how people evaluate them. They say, how did you do relative to the blue chip? And the closer you are, the better. It's not like even like, oh, I did better. It's not even that you want to do better. You want to do the same or roughly the same, maybe with a cheaper fee.
The other thing I try to get across to people is, let's say you're in a mid-cap fund or a large-cap fund, whatever it is, and your fund manager knows full well like a major market correction is coming, and the best thing to do is move that money to cash for a month.
Yeah.
He can't do it. And then when people start liquidating the funds because it's going down and they don't want to hold the fund that they know is going to go down, all he can do is sell equivalent shares to cover the outflows.
Yep.
And so it becomes a self-fulfilling collapse of, a prophecy of self-fulfilling collapse.
Yeah. It's there's a lot of problems with modern finance. There really are.
Do you think that maybe the dynamic with Bitcoin price is going to change, though, somewhat more volatile, or more like, as you have these climbs, more drops before the next climb? Because one thing about the ETFs, we are bringing in a new class of investor, and they're, if I'm your financial advisor and I'm old school about how I do things, and I've calculated, like, Stephen, what we need to do is make sure that you have a return of investment of at least 10% per annum until you retire, and then you'll meet your retirement goals, and I have a 40% return in a month.
Yeah.
I'm going to cash that in.
Rebalance.
Right? Like, I'm going to cash that in and rebalance because I just met your goal for 4 years in 1 week. Right?
Totally. Yeah, that's right. That's going to happen. But it's also, that's offset, In order to rebalance, you first had to buy it. So it's still like net positive buying pressure.
Mm-hmm.
I think what you see is, instead of these giant 4 year cycles, I think you get a lot of mini cycles. I think you get a lot of runs up, goes down, but not 80%, just like small down, up, small down. Like, I think we get more mini cycles, but predicting that stuff's a fool's errand for me as well. Like, take everything I said about that with a grain of salt. Nobody knows the future. Nobody knows how the market structure is going to develop. I would bet, though, we start transitioning from this giant 4 year peak to just more like, smaller up and down. I think you still get a great rate of return. It's just in pieces
and less volatility. So each cycle, volatility. Like, if you did a you do a track record of Bitcoin's progression forward from inception, the volatility ball in each cycle is huge. And as you go to each epoch, that ball kind of shrinks on a graph if you impose that. And I think we continue to see number go up, but volatility, not day to day, but per cycle or per any period of significant time, annual, go down as there's more money in there to stabilize things. And that was actually a good reason to invest a long time ago. I mean, I look at it this way. I'm a holder. I just always hodl. I don't want to spend it. I got that little pocket money. And it's because I sat and looked back at it. And even with money I made when I used to trade shit coins and all, yep. And I made some really good trades. Every Bitcoin I didn't buy, I regretted. Every Bitcoin I spent, I regretted. Every bit of Bitcoin I sold to do something else with, I've regretted. And so once you do that long enough, you're like, I don't want to do this anymore. The formula is simple. Stack and leave.
100%. I learned that lesson at the end of 2017. I was doing shit coins at that time, and I had had some that were very successful, and I thought I was so smart, and I'd made money. And then I did the math, and I just did the math. If I just put all the money in Bitcoin when I started and just held it and did nothing, I would have made more money for way less stress.
Yeah.
And that was a learning curve for me.
I have the lesson I call the $60,000 shotgun. So back in, it was around 2014, I was at an event. We had like a barter blanket thing going on. And dude had this gorgeous Browning pre-World War II A5 shotgun. And he wanted like $1,200 in value for it. And Bitcoin was like 600. And I'm like, I'll give you one Bitcoin and I will sit down with you tomorrow when we're all sober. And I will teach you how to set up your wallet and all that so that you can manage your Bitcoin. And he wanted Bitcoin more than he wanted money. So I gave him a Bitcoin at $600. If I had just done what I should have done, which was turn around and bought another Bitcoin and put it back in the stack, but I wasn't in that mindset back. That was a long time ago.
Yeah.
And so now every time I look at that shotgun, I'm like, I really love that gun, but I wouldn't pay a Bitcoin for it today.
Yeah.
You know, and I think we all have stories like that if we've been in the game a while.
Absolutely. Absolutely. If I had just bought just Bitcoin with most of the money or even half the money at my disposal when I first discovered it, I mean, I would be, you know, much richer than I am. But everyone has that story because nobody kind of goes all in on day one.
Yeah. 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 And everybody says they would have. No, you didn't. You wouldn't have because you didn't. Right. And most of us that had a good stack back in those days when it was, you know, a few hundred bucks, we spent so much of it. Especially like I was an affiliate for a lot of different companies. And, you know, I remember getting like 0.01 Bitcoin for an account on Coinbase.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Right. Like it was $10. That was $10 back then, you know.
Bitcoin and
like
faucets, sign up, benefits.
Yeah.
I mean, you know. It's
but
crazy.
Like, you know, this is part of what I think the conversation leads, though, is people say they would have if they had known. Well, everybody would have done everything if they knew. I would have put a lot of money on a lot of Super Bowls if I would have known. Right. But I didn't know. And you can't know. But Bitcoin had to go through that to get to where it is. And I think it's a much safer place to put money in today than it was. You know, people say, if I could go back to 2014, you wouldn't have because it wasn't as clear that Bitcoin was going to achieve what it had. It's safer.
Much riskier. Like there weren't the resources. There weren't the education resources. There weren't even the platforms to buy it. And it was so much harder. Mm.
Yeah.
So yeah, no, it's, and like, I'll tell you, like I work in this industry. I talk to people all the time. There are very, very, very few people that just like bought it in 2013 and just held it all the way. Like very vanishingly few, right? I know many people that were early to Bitcoin. I know many people that bought Bitcoin in 2013 or 2011, or I know very few that just like held it.
What are you guys doing today? Like, I know, like, one of the things that sold me on Swan when I first heard about you guys is you're all about self-custody.
Yep.
And almost every other place you can buy Bitcoin, even if you can, they don't, like, constantly stick in your face that you should. They don't set up the automation that Swan has where I can regularly buy in, but I can also regularly withdraw. I can set that up completely automated. And so I'm sure you have people that are finding Swan after the ETFs. And maybe they took some of that money and they put it into an ETF because it was walled off. But they're like, I have other money. And how, like, is there like a learning curve for those people? Because one of the reasons the ETFs work so well is there's so many people that have money that they're used to logging in or making a phone call and saying, I want, you know, X.
Yep. So it's actually interesting. After the ETFs launch, I'll be honest with you, I was like a little nervous. I was like, huh, is it going to change? Are a lot of people just going to go to the ETFs now?
Yeah.
Are you going to be having less conversations? And I was like watching very closely to see how things performed. And actually, our volumes got higher than ever. And so I think what has happened with the ETFs is it's like, yeah, like a percentage of all people coming in are just going to go to the ETFs now. But the number of people coming in has 10x'd. And so if there's 10 times more people and half of them are going to the ETFs, that's still 5 times more people that are coming to us, et cetera, like, and companies like ours. And I think that's basically what happened. You just had this multiplier effect because, yeah, interest in it, even people with retirement accounts, people with custodial funds, I mean, all sorts of things. People just, they're more interested in Bitcoin. They want to own real Bitcoin. They'd rather, you know, have the actual asset or pay fees once instead of every year than, you know, buy these ETFs. You know, some people buy the ETFs and that's fine, but we're talking to more people than ever.
I'm also thinking we probably have more and more people that have the surplus capital that would have used vehicles like real estate in the past that are thinking maybe that's not the way to go. Real estate is not portable. It takes time to unload if you don't want it anymore. The advantage with real estate is that I can buy it with somebody else's money.
Sure.
That's the big, but other than that, it doesn't really have any advantages against Bitcoin. I can't take it with me if I leave the country. I have to pay tax on it. I have to pay upkeep on it. It can burn down. Right. Yeah. It could be a wildfire or an earthquake, you know, and you have insurance. But anybody that's been through a total loss with insurance knows it's not like an instant fix.
Nope.
Are you seeing more and more people like just change or maybe even following like smaller companies following the MicroStrategy approach of let's take our long term surplus capital and sweep it into Bitcoin?
Absolutely. Yeah, we see this all the time. And like if you do the actual numbers on real estate, people don't know how to do the math. Like they don't know how to do the accounting. Now, should you own your home? Should you own the home that you live in? Sure. Like that's fine. You've got to live somewhere. Like that's a different calculation. But the moment you're talking about buying an investment property, you need to do the full accounting. You need to take, you're going to take, let's just call it $100,000 to do this. Okay, that's your investment capital. You're going to pay this amount in interest. You're going to pay this amount in property taxes, this amount in insurance. You're going to pay this amount in upkeep. There's also labor that goes into it. You're going to spend your time. Okay, let's add that all together. We'll assume a growth rate of 2% on the property. You're getting offset by interest, like all these things, right? And you need to see what that final number is after 5 years. Then you need to take that and compare it to if you just took that $100,000 and you just put it into Bitcoin, what would be a reasonable expectation for growth there? And you'll see that like real estate really as an investment property, unless it's highly leveraged and in a very successful area, it generally doesn't even really like keep pace with stocks.
Yeah.
Because there's just it's a lot of the costs, a lot of the upkeep, a lot of the hidden, you know, elements. Now, like if you can get really cheap loans and a lot of leverage, that can change it. But the average person can't. Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, if you want to buy your home, great. I think it's beneficial to own your home because you'd be paying rent somewhere else.
Yep.
But outside of that, I don't really see real estate as a high growth investment class right now.
Well, and I think you kind of hit on this earlier when you mentioned it, but there's no cost of owning your own Bitcoin. I don't even have a quarter point that goes to BlackRock or something. If I have Bitcoin secured with a hardware wallet, my cost of storage is zero, right? There is no cost. There's no maintenance. There's no nothing. It just sits there, holds, and grows value across time. And I can't mess it up, right? Like it's the Bitcoin network, for all the talk of like it doesn't do anything or whatever, it is the most secure and most powerful computer network on planet Earth ever. Like nothing else even gets close to the security, size, and power of the Bitcoin network.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And that's what makes that investment secure. And like people talk about the cost of Bitcoin. Well, it costs money when you move it, but it costs money to do anything that has value.
Sure.
But it costs nothing to hold it.
Yeah.
It costs nothing to hold it. Have you guys been working with people a little bit on things like the concepts of UTXOs and all as they're doing withdrawals? Because, you know, back in the day, I used to say this all the time. I'm like, every time you receive Bitcoin, create a new address because it makes it less where people can track you. Like one of my concerns was, let's say you have a company, you're selling product and you take Bitcoin. Even before you worry about government or somebody showing up at your house and shooting you, I could sit there and look at your catalog of products and figure out what your best sellers are. Like just corporate, you know, competition espionage type things. And now that doesn't seem to make as much sense because if you have like $30 sitting on a UTXO, that's no bueno.
Yeah, no, you can't do that anymore. And yeah, we do talk with users and clients about that. So what you're referencing for the audience is that like transaction fees have been growing. Now they're not super high or anything. Let's be clear. We're talking maybe it's $10 to send a transaction or $15. But the thing is if you have, so a UTXO is kind of, think of it, this is a complicated concept. It's hard to explain easily. It's like a unit of Bitcoin. It's not like a Satoshi, like a unit of Bitcoin, but it's like a chunk of Bitcoin. And you basically have to send each UTXO as its own kind of data output, and you pay for the amount of data you use on the network. So if you've got a $30 UTXO and transaction fees are $10. Now, if you're spending $100,000, you don't care that transaction fees are $10. It's meaningless. Mm-hmm. But if you're sending $30, that's 30% of your payment is going to a fee. So because fees maybe were 50 cents before, maybe they're $10 now, they go up and down, they fluctuate. But yeah, you can't have those small UTXOs. You need to have, I would honestly say, like at least $500 UTXOs, right?
Yeah.
Just like, that's being conservative. I'm assuming future growth, but I think you're going to see future growth. I think you're going to see layer one transaction fees going up. So the good news is the only way you create those UTXOs is how big the amount of Bitcoin you withdraw is. So you could buy $20 of Bitcoin a day, but as long as you withdraw it all as one chunk, you have a big UTXO, right? So it doesn't matter how you buy it. It matters how you withdraw it.
And I've been telling people that for years anyway, to not withdraw every time you buy some Bitcoin from an exchange, no matter where it is. And people are like, but Jack, you're always talking about self-custody. I'm like, I am, but I'm back to the checking account thing, right? Like if you, I don't care. I really don't care who you buy from as long as you're comfortable with them. But I'm saying once you get up to like a $500 balance, pull that shit out and then do it again and pull it out. If you're buying $20 a week, like you said, wait till it accumulates. And I think one of the problems we have in the Bitcoin space when new people come into it, this guy's sitting on, you know, a couple hundred thousand in a 401k. He's got a bank account. He's got all this money all over the place. He goes and he buys $200 worth of Bitcoin, and it becomes the most important thing in his life. You know, he doesn't log into his 401k every day and check the balance, but they refresh the balance on the Bitcoin, $200 worth of Bitcoin, 18 times a day.
I know.
And if they bought because you recommended it, because it happens, then you hear
from the guy they call.
Went down today. Okay, you're out $5, dude. This isn't for you then. I think that we do have that issue, but the other side of it is I want those, every call but calls them plebs now. That's relatively new in the Bitcoin space, honestly, even though it's been around a while. But we need those new people coming in and soft walking it at first, but we also have to like set expectations. Like, yes, you could buy $200 worth of Bitcoin. It could be worth $150 tomorrow. And it could be worth $350 tomorrow. And you just don't know, and just relax.
There will be volatility. Yeah.
And if there wasn't, there wouldn't be opportunity, right? Like,
correct. Yeah, that's why you're going to make money. Like, it's, you know, volatility is vitality in many ways. If your asset has no volatility, it has no returns either.
Do you have any insight on maybe why more people, especially larger companies, are not following the MicroStrategy playbook? Because did it, it is a guaranteed number go up. Like, if 100 MicroStrategies hit this year, it's game on like you can't even imagine.
I love that you asked this question because it's an important one that not only helps people understand Bitcoin, but it helps you understand the state of the world right now. There's a very specific reason why other companies aren't following MicroStrategy. And it's because our economy has been captured by committees. Okay. It is a death by bureaucracy.
Okay.
You will never get through a committee of board members and shareholders and process, let's put our money in Bitcoin. why do I think this is true? What evidence do I have to back up what I'm saying, that it's the committees? Every single company that public company that has adopted Bitcoin is founder controlled. There is one guy, Saylor, Elon, Dorsey, that can just say, hey guys, this is what we're doing.
Yeah. Let's take a vote. I own 51% of the shares.
I vote yes.
Yeah.
We have a governance problem in corporations in America and the world where there's no like leadership and accountability and risk has been dispersed and spread through a million bureaucratic tentacles. And it's just like you can't move through that system. Those committees will only ever adopt Bitcoin once it is normative to do so. And until then, you're looking at founder, leader, like companies where there is a leader who can make decisions. Those are who will, every company that's adopted it will fit that profile, and the committee companies will not until it becomes normative. And that's correct. Just how it works.
Yeah, I mean, many years ago, I sold hardware into the central office space for like common carriers and OEM, like for Lucent and Alcatel and all. And our only real competitor in that space was Cisco. I worked for a small company at the time called Garrettcom. We had better product for less money.
Yep.
And my number one objection I had to overcome is, but no one ever gets fired for buying Cisco. Right? And you had to push through those committees,
it's risk avoidance. That's it. It's just like, everyone just doesn't want to. It's the same thing with the fucking hedge funds, man. Everyone is just avoiding doing the thing that they could possibly get blamed for.
Yeah.
And it's just they're doing the thing that like, well, I don't care if it went poorly. If you did the right thing, nobody cares. And that is a broken way to run an economy, to run a company, to run like – you need to align incentives. People need skin in the game. You need to have a payoff if you take good risks and make upside. And you also need to be accountable for your downside. But that's not the world we live in right now.
As we get near the end here, I want to come back to where we started off without planning, which is talking a little bit about lifestyle. In your notes, you talk about living a circadian lifestyle, which is the regular timing, right? Like get up about the same time, go to bed about the same time, things like that. And the benefits of sunlight, getting out from underneath the artificial light, you're outside right there. Can you talk about that a little bit? Because I do find a lot of overlap with like what I call real and right living and the Bitcoin space.
Absolutely.
I mean, that's why I have Bitcoin Breakout, because I wanted to bring Bitcoiners into my world.
Absolutely.
As much as I wanted to bring my world into Bitcoin.
Yeah. So, yeah, I'm big on this. Like you go on Twitter, like I'm like the Bitcoin guy that is known for sunlight, et cetera. So I started doing this about 8 years ago. And, you know, you grow up in the modern world, and unless you were fortunate enough to grow up maybe a little off the grid or a little, you know, like not in the normal American thing, you grow up mostly inside, artificial lighting, indoors, you go to public school, you're stuck at a desk for 8 hours, you get a job, you're inside for 40 hours a week, right? And it's really misaligned. So like, you know, very few people grow up like being taught this, but I got into kind of the science and some people that were really big on this like 8 years ago. And what I learned is that actually light is one of the most bioactive substances on the planet. It's like a drug. Like it has that much effect on us. And if you don't believe me, or if this sounds crazy, go sit in a pitch dark room for 24 hours and tell me you don't lose your fucking mind. Like you will feel crazy. There's very little tolerance for it. And, so I kind of restructured my, you know, so yeah, waking up at the same time, going to bed at the same time, seeing the sunrise as soon as you get up, getting outside, getting that morning light in your eyes, your whole system wakes up, you feel good. And I actually also avoid most artificial light at night. So I have these red, they're circadian friendly light bulbs that, you know, for 2 hours before bed or whatever, I'll turn those on. And I'll put red filters on my devices. So it's the light and it's the dark. And what the research is showing us is that like it's foundational for health. And it's like you know, you want to talk about like testosterone and hormonal balance, muscle gain, all these sorts of things, like completely mediated by circadian pathways. You want good hormonal health. You need to be out in the sun. You need to be seeing the sun. You need to be sleeping well. I mean, dude, like you miss a week of sleep, like your testosterone level gets cut in half. Like it's a very sensitive hormone. So, you know, whatever you're into, or whatever your motivations are, there's a million reasons why this is important. And so, yeah, I'm very big on this. It changed my life. Like it really, really did on so many levels. And it's not just like, I always say this, like, it's not just like some people be like, you can be like, hey, you know, it's really healthy to do this thing or that thing. And it's like, well, what do you mean by healthy? Well, by the time you're 80, maybe you won't have this disease. And maybe yes. Like people are like, okay, man, I don't really care. I'm going to do this for 50 years so that maybe when I'm 80, my life's better. That's a hard sell for some people. My sell on this is I feel better today because I do this. I have enormously more energy, more focus, more concentration, your brain, all of your neurotransmitters, everything. It's governed by your light environment. Like even I would argue, and this is controversial and people might disagree with me, as much as diet, I think it is as important as diet. And, you know, so it's something that matters now. It'll supercharge you now, not later. And the thing is it's free. I'm not selling you anything.
Yeah.
Go outside.
It's go outside. Get in the light.
It's free, man. Just go outside and do it for a week and tell me you don't feel dramatically different. Like that, like do it for a week. It's free. Just wake up with the sun, see the sun for 30 minutes in the morning, take 20-minute sun breaks throughout the day, take a walk. I mean, tell your boss you started smoking, like whatever, like go outside for 15 minutes, you know, like pretend to pick up a cigarette habit. It's doable. Do this for a week and tell me it isn't the best energy of your life. It isn't the best sleep of your life. You don't feel like more focused than ever. So that's my pitch.
I think the circadian thing's important too. Like I don't need to get up as early as I do Monday through Friday on Saturday and Sunday, but I do. I don't necessarily get as active as quickly. If I was like, I'm going to sleep in for an hour, I would get out of bed at 6 a.m, go outside, look at the sky, touch the grass, and then go chill for another hour. Like if I wanted an extra hour, but I'm going to get up. And I'm going to go to bed about the same time every night. And I think that normalizing of sleep cycle. And then I think the light plays into that a lot because I sleep more in the winter than I do in the summer because it stays light out longer in the summer. And it's almost like we're designed that way. And then, you know, you mentioned hormones and what a lot of people don't realize, vitamin D is not a vitamin.
No.
Vitamin D is a hormone that your body makes because you're exposed to sunlight.
Yeah.
And what did we start doing about the same time we went to fiat everything? We started telling everybody to completely cover their body with sunscreen and clothing whenever they went outside. And to me, like causation and correlation are not the same, but they shouldn't be ignored until they're examined. And I look at a lot of things that correspond to the complete adoption of fiat. We kind of talked about this earlier, but in 71, Nixon closed the gold window.
Yeah,
but that was not really the beginning of fiat, and I'm not even like trying to fit in FDR's gold confiscation.
Okay. Yeah.
What I'm saying is somewhere along the way between 1933 and 1971, this whole idea that there was really a, you know, a certain amount of gold for every U.S. dollar printed stopped being true.
Yeah,
and in the late 60s, France called our fucking bluff on that and said you're full of shit.
Yeah.
And they started taking every dollar that came into the French economy and going, where's our gold, bitches?
Yeah.
And eventually it was like a casino issuing chips against money that wasn't there. And when enough people went to the window, we got to close the window. That's closing the gold window. And then in 71, when that happened, I'm sure you've seen the website. What the fuck happened in 1971, right?
Yeah.
And everything bad explodes. Like the number of administrators in education explodes. The number of administrators in medical explodes. The cost of college explodes. Everything corresponds the same way from that one date. And I think it's just when you get to the point where you can just make more money to buy more stuff, you'll buy more stuff, including more administrators and whatever. And then lobbyists go to the government and they say, please govern us harder. Make us have administrators. Because if you're a big company, you can hire them because you're close. You know, the Cantillon effect. You're right there. You can get all the money, and you know your competitors can't. And so food went to crap. Ag went to crap. Everything went sideways, actually vertically, in 71. And so I look at this, and when you talk about, you know, our health, I think Bitcoin fixes our health. Because, again, you start looking for what's real.
Yeah, absolutely. You hear this story over and over again of, like, people get into the Bitcoin community, and one way or another, they end up in this kind of conversation and in this pursuit, and it's critical. I wanted to say one thing. You said, like, yeah, vitamin D is a hormone. And do you want to know how your body makes it? It converts cholesterol into vitamin D. And so everyone's walking around and, like, you know, I disagree with a lot of the cholesterol stuff,
yeah.
But like, okay, there's everyone has high cholesterol. Guess what? Your body naturally turns that cholesterol into vitamin D when you're out in the sun. No one's out in the sun, their cholesterol levels go up. Like, you were designed to be in a certain environment, right? Like, that no matter what your views are about anything, like, you can come at it from any angle you want, like, humans, like, we're not designed to sit inside under fluorescent lights in front of a computer screen for 40 or 80 hours a week. Like, there is important information and inputs out in the world, in the real world, that you need. And, like, you know, you can be somebody that maybe all you care about is not, like, your health. You care about maybe your business, your family, your ability to perform, your ability to be competitive. Guess what? Who's going to perform better? The person whose body is all dialed in with everything they need, or the guy that's, you know, sedentary in front of the computer, which I've been that guy.
Yeah.
Like,
yep.
Which one's going to perform better? Which one's going to be better able to provide for their family? Who's going to get promoted at work? Who's going to, like, make more money? Who's going to be sharper? Who's going to be more focused? Like, I don't care what your goal is, whether it's health, whether it's being there for your kids in your old age, whether it's being successful now, providing for your family, for your wife, whatever, like, you can't escape this. There are certain things in life that just are not optional. They're not optional. And, like, for example, can you eat cake for every meal? No, you can't eat cake. You don't get a choice. I don't care how much you want to eat cake for every meal. That's not, like, a real choice. That's like a... That's kind of a fake choice. And there are things in this world that are that way. And I view this as, like, part of it. It's like, you're designed to work with the light and dark cycles of nature. And, like, the more you align yourself with that, the better you feel, the better you do.
Well, we have had electricity for 120 years and in earnest for 100.
Modern. It's incredibly modern.
You cannot retool 200,000-300,000 years of evolution in a century.
Yeah.
That doesn't work. It wouldn't work for any other species. Why would it work for ours? We're supposed to actually fluctuate in weight. We're supposed to actually gain weight in the fall, going into spring, and then lose
weight.
Like
almost every other species. Almost any other species in a winter environment. Like, and all animals, plants, they all have these circadian pathways, right? Like, anybody that's ever, like, man, if you've ever taken care of animals, if you've ever grown plants indoors, like, if you just have the lights on the plants all the time, or you have a reptile or some sort of other animal or whatever, or, like, chickens in a bar, like, if you just have the lights on 24/7, like, it goes fucking nuts. Like, it goes
crazy.
Like, everything goes, or if it's dark all the time, like, you know, the moment you take care of anything, you start noticing that, like, biology responds to light in a very systemic and key way.
Yeah, my whole back wall of my office is all tropical fish tanks, and everything's on timers. And there was a weekend that happened where my timer broke.
And what happened?
It went 3 days, because it was a long weekend. I didn't even come in the office with no light. And when I realized what happened and turned the lights, the fish were all kind of like, it's not worth it. I don't know how a fish gets depressed.
Yeah.
But exactly. They seemed depressed. Like, they didn't want to do the things that fish normally do. It took, like, a couple days for them to get back, because I know their patterns. I watch them swim around.
Exactly. No, 100%. Like, you can see this with any animal that you care for or plant. fuck with the light cycle. Do something super artificial, like light on all the time or light off all the time.
Yeah.
It'll go to shit in days.
Yeah, I propagate the hell out of plants, too. About a 14-10 is about all they can really handle, the seedlings.
Exactly.
Even in Alaska where they get, you know, they draw the giant cabbages and all, that's not how much light they get as young plants when they're first establishing. You can get more growth with more light, but if you go too far, you go the opposite direction. It's
exactly
everything,
right.
Everything in the world runs what I call beautiful music. Like I just watched this this pattern that's created when you trace Venus and the Earth and their patterns of rotation. It makes a flower in 8 years.
Yeah.
Right? Like everything responds to some sort of the way I would think of it is music. Physics and mathematics are music in reality. Music is mathematics. So mathematics is music. And we can't break that and expect it to go well. You've taken this to the point where you're like walking 10 miles a day and you're a sun maximalist.
Yeah. Yeah. So I walk about 10 miles a day and I've done this for 5 years, 4 or 5 years. And you know, probably 8 or 7 miles a day before that. You know, and I'm fortunate, right? I'm very lucky. I have a remote job.
You have most time.
It's phone calls. What am I doing most? I'm talking to clients. I can do that. There's no reason I need to be in a chair to take a phone call.
I'm
fortunate in that regard. Not everybody has that ability, but I do, and I'm going to take advantage of that, and I'm going to live this sort of lifestyle. And I mean, I'm a huge – do you want to hear the best data point on walking I've ever – I actually think so. We were born to walk. Like it is. There's almost nothing more fundamental to humans than walking, like in the way that we do. It's something, you know, we're like the only bipedal creature, like we're born to walk. And there's two things. So here, one's a data point and one's kind of a history. The first is they did a study of people with, you know, basically walking and something called all-cause mortality. And so this is basically your chance of dying from anything for any reason. Just, you know, you take 50,000 people, how many of them died? For any reason. And the more you walked, you saw this huge decrease in your chance of dying for any reason. The effect was so large that if you walked 16,000 steps a day, you would be better off starting to smoke cigarettes than reducing your steps to 8,000. The effect size of like your chance of not dying.
Yeah.
Walked an additional 8,000 steps was greater than the total chance of death in aggregate if you were to smoke. That's how big this effect was. It is one of the most important things. And then here's another kind of cool thing. If we kind of look at the record of it's probably about 7 to 8 miles distance of 16,000 steps. So then 8,000 being like 3 or 4 miles. If you look at the record of brains and you look at the earliest, most kind of prototypical, like multi-celled, like small early brains, the brain evolved to do one thing and one thing only. The smallest, most prototypical brains, what do? Movement. The deepest function of the brain is movement. There's all of this resource dedicated to moving the body, moving through space. And so if that's the deepest, earliest function of your brain, it's probably pretty important. And your whole system probably requires movement to be well.
That's absolutely spot on. I also think that coming back to the Bitcoin angle, as we debased our currency, we've led to a lot of people who are poorer, but we also have a degradation of our nutrients and our food supply that goes along with that. And then the poorest people eat the cheapest food, which is the poorest quality. Yeah. And what we really have, I think the vitamin D is a huge part of it. Circadian rhythm is a huge part of it. But with diet and lack of exercise together, what the biggest health impediment in America today is metabolic health. Like we have an epidemic of poor metabolic health. And like COVID is a perfect example. People who are metabolically healthy did not die of COVID. Infinity. Like, yep. No metabolically healthy person died of COVID. And I'm sure somebody will say, I knew this guy and he was in great shape. Did you look at his labs? Was he metabolically healthy? Because that is like the number one differentiator between bad outcomes and good outcomes. Like, I got COVID twice. I didn't, if nobody told me, if other people in my family didn't have it worse than me, I wouldn't have known that's what it was.
So let me blow your mind with something. If you, so metabolic health, right? One of the ways we look at metabolic health is insulin response. So somebody, okay, like they eat, yes, food and they eat carbs or even other things, and the body has like an insulin response. And so in people with diabetes and people with poor metabolic health, there's a not a great insulin response. It's like exaggerated. It's like, mm-hmm, way overcompensating, and they have problems. If you eat, let's say I give you 30 grams of sugar or whatever, or fruit or orange, doesn't matter. Like, I give you 30 grams of simple carbohydrates. If you eat it in the sun, you have a dramatically lower insulin response than if you eat it in neutral lighting. And then if you eat it under artificial white light at night, you have a dramatically higher insulin response. So, like, if I were to eat it, you know, under this cover, I would have like a neutral insulin response.
Okay.
If I would eat it out in the sun with UV light, my insulin response would be way better. But then if I'm eating sugar at 1 o'clock in the morning under a bright white fluorescent in my kitchen, you're actually spiking,
sure, your
insulin way more than it should be.
We're going to have to get Ken Berry's head on that and cause him some angst. That'll be fun. That'll be a lot of fun. Ken, I don't know if you know who Ken is. He's pretty big.
Yeah, who is he?
He is one of the largest influencers in the keto carnivore space. Part of our team here. He's on our expert council and all. And he's, I mean, got like 2.5 million YouTube followers, and he's awesome. All in on this. And I, yeah. But I think that makes a lot of sense. It also starts to show some of the incongruencies where you say, like, if you eat too much fruit and sugar and all, you're going to be overweight. But then we have all these people that live on fruit in the tropics and they're not. Well,
in the tropics.
Right. Exactly. They have 12-hour minimum daylight every day. They live outside. They live in huts. They're always walking around in the jungle. Right.
Yeah.
And they're eating monkey meat and figs.
Yeah. Right? And mangoes, papayas. Yeah.
And exactly. I'm a trust but verify guy, so I will do some research into that. But it's very plausible to me because I've always tried to put some caveats in what my nutritional advice is very much stay on the high fat, high protein, low carbohydrate, low sugar thing. But I cannot, I cannot say that there are not people that live differently than that, that don't seem to be very, very healthy people.
And so let's look at, like, in nature, where are these environments? So, like, where are people naturally keto in nature? Well, people that live in the north in a low sun environment, you know, it's winter, you're the Mongolians, the Inuit, the just, you know, winter in Europe, in Russia. What did you eat in winter? You ate fat. You ate protein.
Seal blubber, man.
There's no carbs. There's no carbs in winter. Like, basically none, unless you, like, stored some. But you're not eating a hard. So no carbs in a low sunlight environment.
Okay.
Where are there naturally a lot of carbs? In the tropics, where there's a lot of sun. So human biology never evolved to process carbs in the lack of intense sunlight. And maybe those two things are linked. Now, you know, health is complex and some people have bad reactions to carbs regardless. But I would definitely, any day of the week, somebody that's living in a tropical environment is going to have a better ability to process carbs than someone living in either the north or inside. And that's the thing. I think there's this component where everybody that's living their lives inside, they're effectively simulating winter. So when these people adopt the ketogenic diet, it's like great because every signal their body is getting is winter signals. There's no UV light. It's not bright. And so they have a great health response. The only kind of thing I would throw out there, and if keto works for you, amazing. I'm really not telling anybody to change anything or do whatever, but I would question, would you have the same response if you were in a tropical environment.
That's interesting.
And the science shows us the body handles it very differently.
It's interesting because I spent 2.5 years stationed in Panama.
Yeah.
And the people ate whatever they wanted.
Yeah.
But they were eating almost no GMOs.
Yeah.
Very little seed oil. Lots of fresh fruit because fresh fruit grew everywhere. Like everywhere. The mangoes dropped so much fruit that when they were dropping, you got nauseated running in formation because of the stink. I mean, that's how much food there was there.
No, I know.
But what you don't have in those environments, there's plenty of animal-based foods like meats and all. They're giant. There were these giant mud crabs. They were like the size of king crabs. Yeah. They just walked around, and people just like clubbed them and threw them in and cooked them, right? But they're low in fat. And what you don't tend to have in nature, no matter where you are in latitude, is high fat and high carb
at the same time.
There will be times when there's lots of carbs, and there's time when there's lots of fat. But those two don't come together often. And where they do come together in temperate climates is right at the beginning of fall. Like when you have a salmon run coinciding with like a fruit drop or something. Yeah. And what do the animals do? They put fat on. What do the humans do in those indigenous societies? They put fat on, and then they get through winter because that fat's a battery, and that fat is not only a battery of calories, our friend vitamin D again.
Yeah.
It is where – that's why obese people always have low vitamin D levels. They actually have lots of vitamin D, but it's all stored. They can't get to it.
That's how I think people should be thinking of like diet is diet cannot be separated from your environment. Mm. Like what is a diet that makes sense given your environment, and what that environment is a light environment. Those are the signals that your body's getting. And so if you're outside in the sun and you're getting high vitamin D and high UV radiation, like, can you eat some fruit as part of your diet? Most people could. But like if you're in the dead of winter or you're stuck in an office every day and you don't see the sun and you're pounding orange juice and Snickers bars, that's not a good recipe. That's going to be bad. Like you'd be better off doing a keto thing, you're not getting the right inputs to handle those carbs and that insulin response. It's environmental. And exactly. Like people don't understand. Like in Panama, in the tropics, in these countries, dude, the food is falling off the trees. Like it's insane. You just like walk outside. If you're thinking early humans didn't just eat the fucking mangoes, that's what they ate. The fucking mangoes, man. Like that's what they did. They were fine. But it's because they were in an environment that supported that. The mangoes were there when the light was there.
Yeah.
The precondition for carbs is sunlight. If there's no sunlight, there's no carbs. If there is sunlight, there's carbs. You can't separate those two things.
Yeah, Bill Mollison, who's the co-founder of permaculture, said the further you get away from the equator and closer to the poles, the more you have to be a carnivore.
Exactly.
Because that's what there is to eat.
Yeah.
And I took a deep dive on this a few years ago. I actually lost about 80 pounds doing this.
Congratulations.
And that started, I think, about 2017, 2018 is when I was like, I got to do something because I'm getting older. You know, I'm 51 years old now. I was heading for 50. I'm a grandfather. Like, I got to fix this. I can't be teaching people to build a good life. And then I'm building a great life except for this body, right? Oh. But so then I took this big deep dive into indigenous populations. The most eaten thing universally across the planet before civilization was shellfish. Once you figure out how to cook it or what to do with it, it tastes good. Before we polluted all the waterways, there were, you could get oysters, clams, mussels, etc. Almost every fresh water, not just salt water.
Yep.
And they don't run away.
You read Weston A. Price?
Yes, yeah, I read the whole book. It was hard, but I did it.
Absolutely, yeah, me too. But it's like, and here's the other thing. So this might piss some people off, probably not in your audience, but
yeah,
I think you can eat keto. If your environment's right, you can eat carbs.
Yeah.
The thing you can't do is eat a vegan diet.
And
so one reason you can't eat a vegan diet is because literally seafood is the only source of certain omega-3 fatty acids in a certain position on the planet. Like you either eat seafood or you don't. You don't have this thing. Like, yes, There's ALA. Your body can like poorly convert about 10% of it to omega-3s. But those acids are actually, if you look at the molecules, they're in a different position. There's different positions they can be in. Omega-3s, which a ton of your brain, a ton of your eyes are, basically exclusively come from seafood. And so if you're not eating that seafood, also taurine, also these other things, there's a number of compounds that you're only getting from those animal sources. And seafood is unique among them. You've gotta eat some seafood, some shellfish, some fatty fish. Like, it is important. And there's a lot of very interesting theories, and these are theories, but they're very compelling about the importance of those marine life to early humans. And you see it in these indigenous populations. They would travel long distances to get fish eggs, to get these compounds, these foods, and they were prized.
Yeah, I get a lot of blowback from vegans. I don't have a ton in the audience, but there are some. When I say that veganism is a modern privilege, because if you do not have supplements to go with your vegan diet, you will not be healthy and you will die. Like, I don't think you're healthy anyway, but if you really dial in, like some of the professional athletes that do it and all, they're taking like more supplements than they're eating food and whatever. But if you want the most nutrient dense food in the world, it's red meat.
Yeah.
Like, it's the most nutrient dense, and especially organ meats. Like, one of the things we do, nobody in my family likes liver. And so what I do is I buy good quality liver.
Yep.
I cube it up. I throw it in the freezer.
Throw
it in the freezer. I grind it. And for every pound of ground beef, we add 1 ounce of liver.
Put a little bit in. Yeah.
And it actually, it makes, like, I don't really love liver myself.
Yeah.
But when you mix it into ground meat, it actually makes it taste better. It's one of those, it's like salt. Like, no one eats a plate of salt, but if you put salt on the food, it tastes better. Yeah.
So something I also, I don't know if you've tried this with your family, but also, like, so when I first got into this stuff, I started cooking organ meats all the time. I was like very organ meat pilled. I was like, okay. And I did it. And like, that was fine. You know, eventually I got a little tired of that. I did kind of supplements, like, you know, like desiccated organs and pills, but pate, I realized they make pate really well. You may have never had it, but it's good. It's
very good.
And you can get it at the store. You can get a liver pate, and you don't even really know you're eating liver. Get a little, like, do a what do you call it? Charcuterie board. You know, get a little meat, a little cheese, a cracker, put a little pate on. It's delicious. Like, you'll love it. And you're getting your organ meats, which is wonderful.
Cool, man. This has been really cool. I didn't know we would end this way. If you do have the time, I've had you an hour and a half. I'd like to kind of lightning round. We have a ton of questions.
Yeah, let's do it. That's fine.
If you can do that, let's do that.
Let me just respond to this real quick. Awesome.
Okay, so let's start going, and we're going to probably start with Bitcoin questions, and I think some of the other stuff came in. A breakdown of 2FA hardware would be a great subject or service. Do you guys use 2FA?
Yeah, of course, and we can talk to you about some of the options like keep key, pass keys, other sorts of things. If you're looking to upgrade your two-factor authorization, Swan can definitely help with that.
This is a question that specifically notes Swan, but it's probably better to answer it from a standpoint of what the hell is multisig for?
Okay. Because
the person asking this question really isn't sure. And so they say, should I sign up for multisig with Swan?
So I'm going to say yes, but I'll tell you why. So multisig is, so when you're holding Bitcoin, right, you basically can get like a, you know, like a device, like a USB device. This is my phone, but like, so you put the Bitcoin key, it's in the device, right? Great. Multisig is you have three of them. And you need two at any time to access it. So it's more secure. You can do different things. Swan holds one key. You get two keys. You're still fully in control of your money. We couldn't move it if we wanted to. Somebody could come. The government could come knock on our door. We still can't move your funds. But if you lose one or something goes wrong, we can provide a backup. So I've got a whole team of guys that work for me. We can get on calls. We can walk you through every element of it. So if you want to do a deep dive, just come over, DM me on Twitter, or just go to the website. But it's a great product.
I also see it kind of as a good tool for estate management.
Yes.
100%. Because like, I don't want to give my son access to my Bitcoin. I trust him, but humans are human.
Yeah.
But I could give him a key.
One key.
One key. And then But when I'm dead, those things can come together and function. Or my son can take the copy of the will and my death certificate and say, I want the other key. I'm sure there's a way to set something like that up.
And so this is just to go through it real quick. The kind of iron, the gold standard for the Bitcoin standard, but the gold standard for this is Swan has one key. You have one key. You give a third key. You put it in a safety deposit box. You take the physical key to the box. You give that to an estate lawyer.
There you
go. They go to the estate lawyer. They open the box. They call Swan. We put the two together. You're good to go.
Yeah, that makes sense. We were talking about ETFs quite a bit. Thoughts on GVTC. When will they stop selling? My view on that is they did math, because I did the math. And I figured out they could lose 85% of their business before they benefited by cutting to a quarter point. I think it's just math.
And they also know who's sitting on giant capital gains who can't sell.
Oh. Like,
if you have $1 million in capital gains, you're not selling to save a percentage point, you know? And so they actually stopped having outflows the last two sessions. So who knows if that continues? It's very early. But they're not going to zero, I don't think. They're not going to go all the way down. I think it'll stabilize relatively soon if it hasn't already.
And once that does, and then the price action starts going up, they're still back. They care total dollars assets under management. They don't really care.
They can grow their AUM even without flows.
Yeah.
Because the Bitcoin goes up.
Yeah. So I tried to move a large amount from Coinbase to I don't know why I started that, because that's not really.
No, you're fine. So yeah, Coinbase can be painful. Swan is one of the best.
Let me read it for the people on the audio then. Okay. So what this guy's saying is, he tried to move a bunch of money off Coinbase to self-custody, and they blocked the movement. My guess is it's probably his first big withdrawal, and they're making sure that somebody's not stealing his money. At least that's their excuse.
Yeah. Yeah. So basically the thing is, with Swan, you can always get a real person on the phone. So we're always there to help and troubleshoot anything. Coinbase is such a big company. Like, they're never going to talk to you, and it can be stuff like this. So
you
can't
get anything done with Coinbase.
No.
And
In the
beginning, they were like one of the best places to refer new people.
They were good, man.
They weren't the cheapest, but they were really easy onboarding for people that were scared. It looked like PayPal. You could say buy, and, you know.
They did a lot for Bitcoin, but, you know, unfortunately, they kind of lost their way a little bit. But, you know, maybe they find their way back sometime.
So this says, I didn't understand, because we call my show TSP because it's a survival podcast, right? But what they were actually – somebody was asking about the ability to buy ETFs in TSP, which is like the government equivalent to a 401k.
Yeah.
I don't think that exists yet, but I don't see why it couldn't eventually.
So it's a thrift savings plan is what it is. And if you can roll it over – so people roll over their TSPs to Swan, and then we buy Bitcoin in it.
Okay.
So this is possible.
Okay. All right. This would be interesting. Eric said, Swan denied me an account, said I appeared suspicious. Strike it is. And I've had issues like this, and I've had a lot more people actually have issues with Strike, with, like, they can set the account up, but then they can't transfer money in because of Plaid or whatever. Like, is there some recourse that a person who's trying to work with Swan can take and say, I am who I says I am, you know?
Yeah, so what happened is, in the last couple of weeks, we've had a fraud wave. So we've had like a lot of these malicious actors trying to set up. And so there's an automated system that's had to be tuned up to be a little more aggressive. Unfortunately, and this is not the first time I've heard this, some real honest users have gotten caught in that process. But just email support. You can also reach out to me. I'll help do this personally. We'll get the account reinstated. This is just, you're just unfortunately getting flagged by a system. It could be maybe a VPN usage. It could be a few things. You can use VPNs with Swan, but if you do it in a certain way from, you know, but, we'll get it reinstated. Like, it's no problem. And I'm sorry you've had that experience. You're not the only person recently. It's a challenge. You're always trying to strike a balance between protecting, you know, obviously the company, because we can pay high costs when those people get through, and not dinging, you know, real users. But we can definitely fix it after the fact. So either email support@swan.com or DM me on Twitter.
And to me, that's a huge thing, because when that happens to somebody with Strike, you can't do anything. They won't talk to you. You'll never get a response. It's very, very frustrating. My experience with Swan Support's been great. I'll just leave it at that. Which Bitcoin connected companies or projects should a top percentile ML engineer data scientist look into? Interesting. My specialty is e-com fraud prevention.
Yeah, I mean, shoot an application to Swan. You know, we do have a fraud team. I mean, that's literally what I was just talking about, is we have a risk team that kind of manages these things. So, yeah, I'd love to see an application. And go to bitcoinerjobs.com. That's a website we run for the industry. There's all sorts of companies on there, not just us. And okay. You'll see kind of what the roles are. But, yeah, there are data scientists and also fraud prevention jobs.
And I will say that, like, in any space, the best thing you can do is have something to bring to the table already. So I had a guy from Praxis on last week, and he was talking about how they have this boot camp for young people, and they're actually building things. And they talk about taking a value approach versus a permission approach. So actually build a thing and take that to your employer, or build that thing and take it to your prospective employer versus saying, hey, I could do this, right? Like, actually do something. And that's kind of what you said earlier.
Demonstrating is better than telling. I'd always rather see someone demonstrate something than tell me what they did. And, you know, there's many ways to do it, but that's good advice. You know, I've been a hiring manager many times, and the thing you need to understand is, like, people are looking at 100 goddamn resumes.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, you need to stick out.
You need to stick out, and you need to take alternate approaches, because I'm not looking at resumes. You know what got me to hire people? When people knocked on the door, came into my office and said, hey, I'm looking for a job. And my PA said, we're not hiring. And they talked around her and got to me. And then I would find that guy a chance. Right. Yep. Like, it's like he pushed because he pushed.
Exactly.
Mike C says, for those who are stacking long term, what is the pathway in the future to be able to access the capital? Because we talk about never selling. And I think there's a point where maybe you either just say, like, okay, I have like 25 years of my life left and I have $5 million. I can spend X and not now live my money. But I think there's also the approach that long term, I see the Saylor approach of debt against Bitcoin in a low loan to value ratio making sense. And the way I've explained it, I'd be interested to hear what you think about this. If I'm a bank, and once we get more mature with Bitcoin, and you want to borrow money to buy a house, if you don't pay the loan back, I have to repossess the house, deal with a fucked up house, try to sell the house to recruit my collateral. If you've posted in a smart contract Bitcoin against the debt and you default, I just take your money.
Yeah, you're going to be able to borrow against your Bitcoin. And so in the future, if you don't want to spend it, you can take a line of credit against it. And that's going to be, you know, that's going to be a thing that people do.
The oldest millionaire tax-free income stream on the planet is borrowing against appreciating assets.
100%.
Yeah, I think that'll happen. I also think we might get to a point like Lightning.
And you can do that today. Like, you can do that today. The terms aren't the best, but you can do it.
For pristine collateral, we need pristine, you know, term loans. Correct. For that to take off. I also think, like, Lightning is not where it needs to be today. Other layer solutions are not where they need to be yet. But I do think in time there will be ways to earn ROI on Bitcoin based on providing liquidity.
100%. Yeah. And that's important. I wrote an article recently, and that was one of the conclusions, is that being able to earn a non-scammy yield on Bitcoin is important because it gives people a reason to own actual coins instead of ETF shares.
Correct.
Well, providing liquidity in some capacity that's like not bullshit will be important.
I'm pretty sure the answer to this next one is no. Can non-US citizens buy through Swan?
Yes, they can.
Oh.
We have a small gap with international wires currently. So if you have a US bank account, we can do it fine. And we can do it if you have an international bank account, call it in the next 3 weeks. It can be trickier with international wires, but we're getting that back.
Very cool.
Yep.
Very cool. I did not know that. And I know you had some issues with Texas. I got caught in that mess, even on my referrals for a while, but that's cleaned up. Yeah, that wasn't Swan's doing. That was the government's doing. As usual, a problem goes back to the state. Builder of Castle says, in the near future, everything will be priced in sats, microsats, picosats. I'm not sure about that, but okay. But he says, are you seeing any names for subsats coming up yet online, like anything like that, where people are starting to call like 100 sats a thing or something like that?
Not so much yet, but I get what you're saying, and it certainly could be the way certain things play out. But I haven't seen that in any sort of, like, I mean, people have pushed names around, but nothing that's gotten any traction.
Okay. Yeah, I don't know that that's going to happen. I do think maybe exchanges, especially shitcoin exchanges, might start naming like a block of sats something just to make it seem more affordable.
Oh, sure. I mean, unit bias. Absolutely.
The same way that, you know, companies will split a stock as the price got too high, right? Like, because then, like, people think this way. Like, I'll buy silver instead of gold because I get more shares. 20% on your money is 20% on your money, but
exactly
there
right.
is that. Does the new Swan Vault multi-sig include existing IRA accounts? I really want to hold my keys.
It does not. So the problem with IRA is every lawyer we've ever talked to, there's something called the McNulty case. And so this was someone who owned gold in a self-directed IRA. And at one point she took custody of the gold and the IRS treated that as a distribution. It was like she took the money out. And we've never been able to get a big law firm to write a letter saying, yeah, if you do multi-sig, you won't get tax penalties. So the IRA product is custodial. If the law changes, we'll be the first to offer a non-custodial option there.
And there are self-custody IRAs, but the thing about those is you better do all your paperwork right. I'll just leave it at that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I honestly think with IRAs right now, if you already have like a conventional IRA somewhere, the ETFs make a lot of sense for that, right? Unless you want to go through a role and then work with someone like Swan. Here's, we got one interesting question, and I don't know this one. Does soaking liver in milk affect its nutrients? I will say I don't think it makes it taste better, so I don't do it.
So I know people that do this.
Yeah.
I don't know the answer to your question, but what I will say is that, like, nutrition and biological sciences are very complex, and I'm always hesitant to, like, if humans have been doing something for a long time, I'm inclined to believe there's a reason they've been doing that. And I know this is something that people have done, so there very well could be an interaction there that's important, but I don't know. So
I think it might have a little effect on the mineral taste because it's going to leach blood.
Yeah.
So it's going to leach iron and some other minerals, but I don't know. I still don't really care for liver by itself. Like you said, pate is good. Liverwurst is good. Sausage is good. Yeah. Like, there's lots of ways to get it in your diet. Stephen, this has been a fantastic interview. If you'd ever like to come back again, we'll have you back on, and we can talk about Bitcoin and Swan, or, you know, if you ever want to come back on and talk about health and nutrition and stuff, like, that was a great part of this discussion. So thank you so much for being here today.
Yeah, absolutely, brother. This was a pleasure. I'd love to come back and, yeah, enjoyed all parts of the discussion.
And I'll throw one more thing at you. I'm robbing this from John Kempf and his podcast on regenerative ag. Is there any question I didn't ask that you wish I would have?
I think we really went pretty deep, but I think we covered a lot of ground. I nothing jumps out, man. I think you did a great job, and I think we talked about a ton.
Well, thank you, Stephen. I appreciate you being with us today.
Yeah. See you. My pleasure.
Take care. All right, folks. That was a great interview. I really enjoyed talking to him. I think that we are seeing more and more of this overlap of real food, real life, real things instead of fiat things, and it merging with Bitcoin. And the term Bitcoin fixes this has been used an awful lot, and I think a lot by people that don't even understand what that means. They just are parroting it. But I think we're starting to see that in reality, that when we go to real money, we end up using real things. I think there's a psychological component. Long term, I think there will be a spending component, because we talked a little bit about what you do with your Bitcoin eventually. Like, do you sell some and start to live in retirement off of your Bitcoin stack and whatever? And you probably do, but I've said this before. You want me to spend my Bitcoin, you have to sell me something that has the lasting value of Bitcoin. You can't sell me a fiat house for hard money. You have to sell me a hard value house. You have to sell me something like my grandfather bought in the early 1900s, that my father still lives in that house, right? You have to sell me a house like that. You have to sell me a house built out of oak, not number two pine, if you want me to part with my Bitcoin for it. And I think that that is the long-term path. But the short-term path is a psychological path of what Stephen said. If money's fake, what else is fake? And I think as soon as you pull on that thread, you start getting a lot more answers than you expected. With that, one of the best things I think that you can do for your health is to grow some of your own food. And gardening is a great way to do that. I come from a time and place in rural Pennsylvania where more people had gardens than didn't. Like, nobody was like, oh, look, a garden. People were like, why doesn't that dude with the big yard have a garden? That's changed. And I, speaking of value, I've been having a great experience working with Vivor from a standpoint of value. And they have the garden beds that I kind of let off my relationship with them with you guys with. They're on sale again. They have the 4 foot by 8 foot by 2 foot deep steel garden beds on sale for about $96. Plus, you get another 5% off using my code. And if I could real quick, I want to make a little call out. Many of you bought these, but I think many people, you could save even more money. You don't necessarily need a 2 foot deep bed. I have the 2 foot deep beds because that's the depth that keeps birds out of my garden. I have all these ducks running around. I also am old and I don't like to bend over. I also don't have any soil depth because I'm sitting on a rock slab. If you don't have any of those issues and 1 foot deep of the garden bed is good for you, I want you to know they have the 4x8 and they're really like 7'11" by 11", you know, a 4 foot, 3'11" or something like that because they use metrics. But, you know, roughly 4x8 by a foot deep, 23% off right now, $46.99 a bed. They ship in a flat box to your house. You put them together. Make sure you take the protective film off before you put them together, because I put mine together without doing that. But regardless of what depth you want, $50 for a 12-inch deep 4x8 bed, you can't build it out of pressure-treated lumber for that. And this galvanized steel is going to last a lot longer. It's a hell of a deal. It's at the Survival Podcast right now. It's absolute fantastic value for the money. And you're talking about something that's going to last a very, very long time relative to how long, let's say, pressure-treated lumber would work. So definitely check those out. And remember, you can shop the entire VWAR store, 5% off anything with my discount code. It's in my write-up, available at tspaz.com as well. You can also shop on Amazon through tspaz to help us out. So if you can do that, we really appreciate it. Consider my membership product as well. Go to thesurvivalpodcast.com, click on members to learn more. The discounts there alone pay for the membership multiple times a year. Most people I hear from say I make money by being a member. That was my goal when I put it together. With that, we've wrapped up another week of live streams. Tomorrow will be an expert council Q&A show for the week. And that means it will be audio only, and then we'll have a Friday flashback. Next week, we'll be back to do it all again. Take care, guys. Thanks for tuning in today. Are they gonna bail you out or just run you around? They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.